Well, you know what that music means. We're here on the radio hotline tonight, and this is Tuesday, the 16th of August at 8 p.m., and we're on Radio Fairfax, and we're going to be talking about mental health tonight, but first let me say the views expressed by my guests and I don't represent the station or my underwriters. My underwriters are the Heidelberg Bakery Shop and also me, Home Improvements by Dennis Price, building your dreams out of wood, stone, and steel. Tonight, thanks to the Sidewalk Talk. Look it up on the net if you want, under You Talk, We Listen, or under Sidewalk Talk. You find out about that. I've been meeting a lot of interesting people in the mental health field. I'll be interviewing Brooke Braylove. Yep. Is that right? I got it right. Braylove. And let's make sure that mic is up high. Braylove. Tonight. Brooke is a LCSW-C, which is a licensed clinical social worker, psychotherapist, sex therapist, and certified Daring Way facilitator, specializing in treating adults, couples, and groups with depression, anxiety, and relationship challenges. She's a graduate of Sidwell Friends. That's a high school, isn't it?
Yeah, I was a lifer there.
Oh,
PK
wow.
to 12.
Wow. The University of Pennsylvania and Columbia University School of Social Work. Sidwell is in Philadelphia.
No, D.C.
D.C., okay.
Born and raised here.
Okay. Additionally, she's a graduate of the Washington School of Psychiatric Clinical Program on Psychodynamic Psychotherapy and National Group Psychotherapist Institute. She has maintained a private practice in D.C. metro area for more than 12 years. Wow, we got a lot to talk about right there. You know, you have a thing called Daring Way Facilitator. What is the Daring Way?
So the Daring Way is a curriculum based on the research of Dr. Brené Brown, who's a shame researcher out of the University of Houston. She's been studying shame, resiliency, perfectionism, empathy, for more than 13 years. She has a wonderful, wonderful TED Talk that's been seen, I think, 25 million times on vulnerability. And so I did some training with her and her staff in Texas several years ago, and I've been leading these sort of intensive weekend workshops doing her curriculum. Helping people manage the shame in their lives and kind of learn to, the tagline is show up, be seen, live brave. So the real question is, where in your life do you want to show up, be seen, and live brave? And I help people figure that out in a group setting, in a kind of a 2.5-day intensive workshop. It's amazing work. It's really changed my life, both personally and professionally.
Where do you hold these workshops? I mean, do you go to a hotel, or do they come? Do they come?
No,
for a
they
few?
Just come to my office in downtown Bethesda, and we just do it in house. I've had 4 people, and I've had up to 9 people do it on a weekend.
Oh, so it's like it's like you have long sessions during the day. It's not like it's an escape or something like that.
Right.
It's not like you're going on a camp trip and doing this.
Not yet. Maybe one day we'll do that.
That sounds like an exciting idea.
Yeah. It's really, really amazing work. It's been transformative. I have patients that I've seen in my private practice for 2-3 years who do a weekend and really say it's like 6 months of psychotherapy in a weekend. And the group process is really important because many people really suffer alone, thinking something's wrong with them, that they're the only people who worry about what other people think of them. And when you sit in a room full of people and you walk in and you think, oof, what do I have in common with that woman? Or she looks very different than me. And then you realize we all really struggle with the same issues. That's why I love therapy so much. At the end of the day, almost everyone is really wanting to be seen and accepted for who they are. And, I really try to help people figure out what is holding them back from showing up as an authentic version of themselves.
Don't you have to sort of turn your clients into therapists to do this? Because it's a group thing. They're all working together.
Yeah, but I guess in a way, I mean, there is some support.
I mean, the team, in a sense, isn't there like, isn't it become, I don't know, team isn't the right word, maybe.
The group does, it really depends on the particular group, mm-hmm. but there's no doubt that there's a lot of support and empathy in the room, and it allows people to not feel so alone. That is so much of what people struggle with. I must be the only one who has this anxiety or this depression or has this kind of marriage. And again, I think we're all so much more similar than we are different. So I love the group idea. I think it really helps with that.
And what makes this different than a group therapy? I mean, is it because it's longer? What makes it different?
It is very different than a sort of long-term psychotherapy group, which I also run in my mm-hmm. practice in Bethesda. But this is really based on a specific curriculum. So we watch a series of few-minute videos that Brené has on kind of a lesson, and then we do some worksheets and then some sharing around that. So you're really working a curriculum.
There's a structure.
There is a structure to it, yeah.
And just what are some of the worksheets? I mean, what's the nature of the videos and things?
Well, let's see. I'll give an example. One of my favorite ones is around empathy and what is empathy and what does that look like? A lot of people get confused between the words sympathy and empathy. So sympathy is when I feel for you, mm-hmm. Like I feel sorry for you.
Right.
Empathy is really the expression of I'm feeling with you. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people do not want sympathy. They don't want to be told, oh, you poor thing, I'm so sorry you're going through that in this kind of almost demeaning and distancing way. Sympathy is distancing. Empathy is, wow, that must be really hard. I may not understand it myself, but I can tap into experiences that I've gone through in which I might know what that emotion is that you're feeling. So people will often say, well, how do I relate to my friend whose husband just died? And then I'll say, well, what do you know about sadness? What do you know about loss? And really teaching people, there's no right thing to say. Sometimes just holding space for someone and doing a nonverbal, touching them.
Holding space for someone.
Holding space for someone, not trying to crowd them out. Oh, that's not so bad. Or
allowing them a place to feel what they're feeling.
Yeah, I mean, that is what psychotherapy really is mm-hmm. is allowing people the space and the permission to feel all of their feelings. So many people are told from a very young age, your feelings are not okay. The only feelings that are acceptable in this house are happiness.
And they may not be told in those words exactly.
That's right. Absolutely. There are many people, and that's an extreme version, although mm-hmm. I will say a lot of people are told that. But in essence, a lot of parents, without meaning to, will hurry their children.
Oh, you're not
through.
Sad. It's okay. You get over it. Don't stop crying. You'll
right.
be fine. It's not a big thing. There's
right.
no reason. Right.
And, the best thing is, don't cry. I mean, I've even said that to my children mm-hmm. at times, and I'll just kick myself and say, when in the history of don't cry has that really helped anyone stop crying?
And I guess a lot of people, what they're looking for is not... I don't know, people are looking for different things at different times, of course, but I mean, when you say empathy, you could be making the space for them to feel their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Or not need to fix it.
Right, not to control what they're doing, but to maybe, I mean, that making the space for them to feel it is maybe one step, and another step beyond that, not that you have to even go there yourself necessarily, is empathizing, is feeling mm-hmm. what they're feeling, thinking, well, I lost my dog once, and how did I feel like, I felt like that? Because our emotions are all the same, even to the events that spark
exactly.
them.
Exactly, and that's the thing is, when you say, well, I don't know how to, respond to when,
I've never had my father die
right.
or something like that yet.
Right.
I haven't experienced that.
But then
that.
When you say, well, what has happened in your life where you felt sad? Everybody knows those feelings. And so the thing about empathy that's so important, and Brené's work really centers around vulnerability. So for me to be truly empathic toward you and to express that is that I have to tap into my own vulnerability first. I have to conjure up a feeling in myself and then try to express that to you. So it's about shared vulnerability.
So when you say shared vulnerability, in a sense, what you're saying is to be willing to expose yourself on that emotional level. I mean, I'm sure a lot of why, you know, the old image of the father snapping and saying, don't cry, stop that, was because it was bringing them into an uncomfortable zone where they weren't allowed to be.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. When I, if my daughter comes to me feeling anxious, that often stirs my own anxiety. And so I may try to calm her down. And often, again, that same thing, calm down, never in the history of anyone saying that has that worked. Because what I'm really saying is I'm not okay when you're not okay. And so it's a very fine, it's very difficult for parents to do this. It triggers their own stuff.
It sounds very much like it's an emotion-centered philosophy in the sense that you're trying to get into the emotional and to understand your own emotions and get a read on yourself.
Absolutely. Well, that's what real intimacy is about. We truly cannot be intimately connected unless we are willing to be vulnerable. And vulnerability is super scary for most of us. And yet, vulnerability, Brené talks about, is sort of the birthplace of love, connection, faith, creativity. And we can't do that without being vulnerable. If I'm not willing to make myself vulnerable, I can't be truly intimate with you.
I guess the image I have is of a cat rolling on its back and exposing its stomach.
Right. So that's a great example, right, where people would feel that that is, you know, not smart on the cat's part, right? Sort of this idea of vulnerability being exposing your jugular, right?
Or maybe a dog.
Cats
got plenty of claws. Although when you think about it, a lot of people are cats in the sense that they might expose themselves. And if you scratch them and uncomfortable, I mean, if you rub them and they get uncomfortable, then they'll start to... The analogy can only go so far.
Right.
But for a dog, in a sense, it is a position of showing... you know, a certain amount of trust and vulnerability.
Right. Well, vulnerable, for many of us, we learn very early on that vulnerability is weakness. And Brené is really turning all of that on its head. Vulnerability is actually our most accurate measure of courage. It takes a lot of courage to go in and tell your boyfriend that you love them first and not know whether you're going to hear those words back. That's being vulnerable. But without that vulnerability, you can't actually have the closeness. We must dare. We must dare greatly in order to feel alive and be fully present. And most of us live very scared, very safe and very scared. And really, it's not about the absence of fear. Courage is not the absence of fear. It's feeling the fear and doing it anyway.
Yeah, but you know, courage is an odd thing in the sense that when we think of courage, we tend to think of charging the ramparts of something. And
those people are incredibly afraid as they're doing it.
Well, and they probably are, but I'm thinking in smaller things, you can show lots of, I mean, it doesn't, we tend to go to these high and heavy emotions and things like that, but courage is a relative thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess it doesn't, I mean, just to be opening yourself up is being vulnerable, I suppose. I don't know, there's something, I guess I'm being bothered by the expression of vulnerable. I understand that you are being vulnerable when you expose yourself to emotions, but that would suggest a weakness.
That's right. Well, that's what we're taught, that I can't tell people how I feel because they can hurt me. But really, you know, you're closing off your heart. If you choose not to be vulnerable, which many people do choose, there's really not the potential for deep connection.
And I would think of the thing that you have to deal with is you deal with a lot with I statements and stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, that's a lot of the work in group. It's a lot of my work with couples. I always say if you're going to start a sentence off with you, you've already lost the other person pretty much automatically.
I'll do an I statement. I feel you're wrong. No, I mean, but I mean, because it's so easy to get to lose sense of what your own emotion, it's a very hard thing to have that lightning. You know, I worked on this hotline as a volunteer, and we were very feeling orientated. And when we answered the phones, we would reflect back what people's feelings were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting experience. It taught me a lot in that if you could identify other people's feelings, you could identify your own and be aware of yourself in these things. And it's almost like out of physics where you don't realize what an effect you're having on an object, and if, you know, when you're looking at something, and so you don't know what your own emotions are affecting things. So if you know what your own emotions are, you can sort of figure it out. So it makes things so much clearer when you understand yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why couples work starts with each individual. I mean, people come to couples work and they basically want me to tell their partner that they're wrong. And I don't spend any time doing that. I ask them to, you know, they want their partner to change. And my job is to figure out what each person can do to change themselves. And therefore, sort of dynamically, the relationship changes.
55 or 45 minutes once a week. And we were talking...
Slowly.
About, yeah. Well, we were talking about it. It's kind of like my poor daughter wrecked her ACL, and she's in physical therapy. And physical therapy is only once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. And the brain is sort of a muscle, and you're fixing it up in its own way with the sort of a training session. You're telling them the exercises to do, setting an example.
Yeah, I mean, again, we sort of think that, you know, marriages are supposed to, you know, come work easily, and we're supposed to manage all these feelings, but we go to the gym a lot more than we go to therapy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do feel that, you know, there is discomfort in growing. And similar, I use the gym analogy a lot, which is that when you are trying to push yourself further, you have discomfort. And you have to keep going through the discomfort. Well, feeling difficult feelings is uncomfortable, and that's why people avoid them. But you're stretching those muscles, and soon you're going to get through difficult things. So it's really, I feel like a lot of people come to therapy with the idea of, how do I get over something? And I'll tell them right away, you're not gonna. That's not the goal. The goal is to live with it, especially when you're talking about real loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can I get over... you know, my father's death. You're not going to.
Or the loss of a partner, not necessarily to death, but just to divorce or betrayal or
absolutely.
Or
and then they basically feel shame. What's wrong with me that I can't get over it? And that's sort of the message. Why aren't you over this yet? You should be over this. This is, you know, most people are only unhappy for 6 months. And there's a lot of judgment there. So one of the first things I do is just to say, that's not the goal. We have to live with pain and
I think in that situation that you're describing too, a lot of people will tell you, you know, you should just break up with that person. You should just get over it. You should just, you know, it's time to leave the relationship.
And that's based on their discomfort in hearing difficult feelings. What they're saying is, you're making me uncomfortable.
I liked it when you had a settled relationship. So either break up or stay with this person.
Right, right. And real empathy is just saying, wow, I don't know what you should do, but I'm here and I'm listening. And it sounds like your work on the hotline was really the most important work in the world. I mean, some of the most basic couples therapy is simply around mirroring how to hear what your partner is saying and simply say it back and kind of asking, is that right? Did I get it right? Is that how what you were trying to tell me? And you can do that for sessions, especially with high-conflict couples who mm-hmm. immediately go to, but I, but you, but I, you know, and they're interrupting each other. It's just simply, again, holding space. I hear what you're saying. I may not understand it, so tell me more about it. The best thing couples can do, and really individuals, is to bring their curiosity. I had a bumper sticker from a very well-known therapist that said, less judgment, more curiosity.
Oh, wow.
And that is so important. People's judgment of others and themselves is so profound that it gets in the way of being curious. And we only grow by being curious about ourselves and about the people around us.
Wow. That's a lot to think about there. Mm-hmm. This is Dennis Price on the Radio Hotline. And I'm, why is it? Braylove.
You got it.
I'm getting there. You know, I'm as a dyslexic, sometimes when I see a word, the immediate imprint comes in my mind of what it is, but Bray, I'll remember that now, because if you pronounce it, it's Bray, B-R-A-L-O-V-E, Bray Love. So you have been in practice for 12 years.
Yes.
What did you do before you were a therapist?
Before I was?
Yeah. Remember that time 12 years ago?
I
when
do.
You were when you were 12?
Right, exactly, exactly. So I came by becoming a psychotherapist in sort of an interesting way, which is while I was at UPenn, I was an Afro-American studies major.
I noticed you weren't black, though.
I am not black. I am Jewish, as a matter of fact. So that was something that I think, you know, a lot of people are going, what the heck's that about? But I just followed, again, my authenticity there. And I basically decided to study what I was most interested in.
You know what I'm hearing from you right now is you really like this...
Brené Brown.
Right, the daring way.
Yes.
You really like that. And you've taken the stuff that you've learned in that and shined it back on your life and said, you know, I was happy. I was doing this. This is what was going on with me mm-hmm. then. These are the things I was doing. I was using my authenticity at yep. that point, just being me.
Yeah, and it was, you know, a little bit strange to a lot of people, and I get that. But
being a minority and studying a minority makes sense to me, an intellectual level and emotional.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually quite challenging. It was not so easy all the mm-hmm. time, but I really think of it as kind of a gift because I did get to experience what it's like to be the only person in a black room, in a black crowd, things like that. So to be another, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not suggesting I know about racism. I'm not going to suggest that, but I do know what it's like to be. You know, kind of stared at and really stick out. And I really felt like it made me a lot stronger. It was not always pleasant, but I think it's something that a lot of white people don't ever have to go through. And it really made me stronger. Now, what it also did, though, is I did try to kind of bring a lot of racial awareness and do some sort of interracial coalition. And I did find that was really hard and a little bit kind of an uphill battle. So I sort of took those experiences.
You mean the racial, trying to bridge the gap, some sort of organization?
Yeah,
or something
yeah, like kind of even socially. Mm-hmm. And it was challenging. And so what I decided is that rather than trying to kind of change people in sort of groups, that I really just wanted to try to change people and help them individually. And so that's really what helped me find psychotherapy. Didn't hurt also that I went to a therapist when I was 9 and found it incredibly beneficial after my parents had divorced and really, you know, just believed in it personally. And I think most psychotherapists really come by therapy in similar ways, I think.
It's interesting because my experience with therapy has and doing the hotline, the two of them have been very positive in that sense. When you were 9 years old, who brought you there?
My parents. I was just, you know, struggling a little bit kind of emotionally and was a little bit shut down, and they suggested it, and I'm very grateful to them. I think one of the best things we can do and I can do is try to normalize therapy. I don't believe there's anyone on the planet who can't benefit from it.
This is the whole idea of Sidewalk Talk, this little organization you're involved in that gets
right.
people to listen.
Right, which is simply offering free listening to mm-hmm. people out and about in the, you know, general D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area.
But mm-hmm. to make
everyone
it,
wants to mm-hmm. be heard. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to someone to listen to them. That is an inherent need. We are built to be connected. We are wired for connection. And that's one way we feel connected, is when we feel really heard.
And that's when you say really heard, what does it mean to be really heard?
I'd go back to that holding space
right?
Which is, I bring my curiosity in something like Sidewalk Talk. It's, mm-hmm. again, I'm not their therapist,
right.
but it's simply to say, hey, what do you got on your mind? Come on and sit down for a few minutes. And people feel really wonderful. I mean, it's a really neat thing when it works, when somebody just comes and goes, oh, wow, I don't know what to talk about. And then they sit down and, you know, they're talking about real stuff. They're talking about, kids in high school, about anxiety going to college. They're talking about infidelity. They're talking about loss and fear and being a new mom. They're talking about all sorts of
all
things.
All in 10 minutes.
All yeah. in about 10 minutes. Yes, exactly.
So you did this therapy when you were young. What did your parents do as far as their careers?
So my mom was the middle school drama teacher at Sidwell mm-hmm. Friends for 24 years.
Wow.
And my dad was, and still is a stockbroker. My mom is now a yoga teacher and a wonderful Grammy to my daughters. But they were just really accepting of, you know, there's a need to talk about things that are difficult. And again, it's not the same to go to your best friend or, you know, or your mom. You really need somebody who can be impartial and it does not have a vested interest in kind of the outcome.
Now, how do I be delicate about this? First of all, this is Dennis Price on the Radio Hotline. Here I am with Bray Love, who is a clinical psychologist.
I'm actually a licensed clinical social worker. So I always say I'm not a doctor.
Right.
Please don't call me doctor.
I'm sorry about that. And, you know, we should be able to give out your website.
Sure. It's brookbraylove.com. And,
I bet you if you even just Googled Brook, that's a pretty distinct
Absolutely. Name. It's a pretty unique name.
Right.
So,
your own personal experiences, including, you know, your parents being divorced and your own experiences in marriage, how do they... And I let you open this up as much as you feel comfortable opening it up. How do they play into what you do?
Well, I think that every therapist really needs to come to terms with and be aware of their own personal issues and make sure that that you do leave space for your patients. So my experience is not my patients. My experience with my parents' divorce is not the same as some of my patients. And so I certainly think that whatever issue, whether it's divorce or loss or...
Do you feel that your own personal life has given you more insight into it? I mean, that you've been married yourself?
And- oh, absolutely. I mean, you know... You hate to hear this when you don't have kids.
Right.
When people say, oh, you don't get it. But then you become a parent and you're like, oh, they were right. It is really hard to get. So I absolutely, being a mom has made me so much better, I think, of a person to really understand how difficult it is to be a parent and the things you go through. Going through divorce absolutely makes me understand more and be able to relate to people. And what's interesting is, you know, a lot of psychotherapists don't really talk about themselves at all. And I certainly don't disclose a ton. But when you are in the middle of working with someone and all of a sudden your wedding ring comes off, people can figure stuff out. And I really think that, and I have a group I've been leading for about 3.5 years now of women. And when they realized that I was going through a divorce was actually when they began to deepen their own work because they saw my vulnerability. So vulnerability is kind of contagious. It's a really cool thing. It's basically it's the last thing we want to show in ourselves, but it's the first thing we look for in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to remember that. When you're afraid to be vulnerable, remember that that's what you want in other people. You want to see them open up.
We give what we want the most for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting what you said about the group, sort of harmonic plucking of the strings there with everybody. But again, I imagine you can bring, you don't, it's not like, you have to commit suicide to know what someone who's committed suicide has gone through. It helps. It broadens your perspective.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have to have the exact experiences. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to what I was talking about earlier. You don't actually have to have the same life experience, but you have to tap into the feelings. Everyone knows sadness. Everyone knows frustration. Everyone knows anger. These are normal human emotions. So you just have to be willing to tap into it inside yourself and also to say, I have no idea what that's like, but thanks for sharing with me.
Let me ask you a question. You have about how many patients? Do you call them patients?
I do. Some people call them clients. Mm-hmm. I just use the word patients. Mm-hmm. I see anywhere between about 22 and 28 patients a week, and I run 2 psychotherapy groups, and then I do Daring Way weekends every, you know, several months or so.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's a lot.
So, well, if you're saying, you said 22 to 27, is that what you said?
Something like that, yeah.
Right. And they're 45-minute sessions?
Yes, 45-minute
sessions. But does it take an hour to do a 45-minute session in the sense of what you have to do for yourself to be prepared?
Certainly, I write notes after. You definitely don't have a lot of time in between, for sure.
But what I'm saying, I guess what I'm saying is I'm figuring out what this... I mean, it's not like you have a patient coming in at 11:15 and then you have another one coming in at 12:30 or 12 o'clock on the nose. I mean,
I try to structure my time where I have 15 minutes between patients, but there are certain days where that's not possible.
Wow.
Today, for instance, I saw 8 patients starting at 7 in the morning and finished a group at 6:45.
You know, they can't see on the radio my eyes popping
up. it's a muscle that you know, I couldn't do this 12 years ago. I could probably only see about 4 patients a day. But you learn how to do it. And I have a max. I mean, I really have a max and I try to.
And you don't do this every day of the week. I work
4 days a week.
Right. Which I think you would burn out if you were doing more than that. That's a thriving practice, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to just understand your own boundaries. So I found that I was rushing to eat in between sessions, and so I've taken the time to carve out a lunch hour again for myself and really put that back into my schedule. Because it's not great to shove a piece of string cheese in your mouth in between sessions.
It's not good for people to hear your stomach rumbling.
No.
You're
no.
empathizing with my stomach right now.
You know? Right, yeah. But no, I mean, self-care is absolutely critical to being a good therapist. I must take care of myself. And that's to being a good partner, to being a good friend, and to being a good parent. It all starts with self-care.
Good limits and boundaries, I guess is what it is.
Absolutely. And boundaries are absolutely critical. One of the things that I love that Brené says is the most compassionate people have the best boundaries.
What if you were going to have someone read one book? I mean, the TED Talk you'd like a person to see. But
the TED Talk is 20 minutes of wonderfulness and absolutely the Brené Brown's vulnerability. But she has several New York Times bestseller, but I do love Daring Greatly. I really think that book is so wonderful and really helps you just look at the ways you hold yourself back or people hold themselves back from fully showing up in relationships.
Well, that's an interesting thing when you say fully showing up. I think about myself sometimes and my wife too. Sometimes we get so caught up in the process of things that, my daughter will get upset because she says, can you go, can you put down the phone? Can you stay away from the computer? Not that we're burdened by the computer, but they know what they want. They have a very strong sense, our kids, and they can tell when we're sort of not being there in a lot of ways. And
it's very difficult to be present. You know, anxieties, worrying about the future, depression sometimes can be ruminating about the past. It's very difficult. I mean, mindfulness and everything that it's done for psychotherapy is absolutely critical.
Oh, we're getting a phone call. I'm not quite sure from who. Let's see. Hello? Hi, are you listening to the show? Oh, well, hold on. Let me put you on, okay? Let me see. Yes, please do turn down your radio as I desperately try to work all the right buttons here. So hold on a second. Caller, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Can you hear? Did you have a question?
Yeah, my name's Ev. I'm a friend of Ev's, but that's neither here nor there. I was called in just because I've been working with a great therapist who had recommended that I join a group at some point. The term he used was it would help him have more leverage. I think it often.
Are we having a little trouble hearing you because he's breaking up? Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit with your phone. Are you on speakerphone?
I'm on a Bluetooth headset, but I can turn that off.
Let's try.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, much better. Okay, I'm sorry about that, but that's much better. Okay, so you're saying you are doing some therapy now, and their therapist was suggesting you go for a group because.
Yes, well, one thing that happened was so my now wife came into one meeting with me.
Congratulations!
It was the best meeting ever. It was like my therapist could really see when I was doing a little bit of BSing, which, you know, I don't do on purpose, but definitely happens. And so he suggested that I join a group session, and it has been, I've really enjoyed it, actually. It's been really helpful to kind of have this sandbox, in a sense, where, you know, you kind of can sometimes go through things with other people who aren't, you know, in your life, but you can kind of, you just say whatever's on your mind or try something out. And so I found it helpful. I was just, I guess, curious about, since I only have my experience to go on, what do you, Ms. Brawlins, is that how I say your name?
Braylove, sorry.
What do you look for when you recommend that somebody join a group as opposed to, you know, individual practice?
Well, I'm a big fan of group, and have really wanted to expand that part of my practice. I think there are, as much as I love individual work, there are limitations. I think that often when people are struggling in relationships outside of a dyad, so people struggling in work relationships or family relationships, joining a group can be, you know, literally kind of a live demonstration of how people interact. So the way I do group is certainly people are talking about their issues that happen outside of group, but I really try to focus on what's happening in the here and now of the group session. So seeing how people respond to criticism, feedback, and
I guess in a sense, the joint session is great. I mean, the individual session or the dyad session is great because it's sort of like you're at the foul line and you're shooting, mm-hmm. but a group session is like the full game.
That's exactly right. And that's why, I mean, in order to truly, I think, fully help people, and the people who I believe have grown the most in my work over 12 years are often people who do both individual and group. And obviously that's very expensive. So I'm not, you know, I understand that's not possible for a lot of people, but for me to be able to see someone individually and see how they interact with me and then see how that's different or the same in a group setting is, it's really like a window into their lives. It's awesome. So that's what I would say, that, you know, and specifically when you're having difficulties outside of dyads, because really a group just kind of mimics a family. So there's competition, there's envy, there's, you know, all sorts of stuff that comes up. It's like siblings.
Hmm. So when you say outside of a dyad, you're thinking that group would typically be for someone who's struggling with not just, say, in a relationship, but with other relationships, either in their family or with friends or in other areas?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're not limiting it to that in the sense. I mean, a group is what goes on in a group goes on in a dyad too.
Absolutely.
It's all there. It just comes out in different ways. So it's all good training for it.
It's all good. Yeah.
Wow. Well.
All right. Well, thanks for the insight. I was just interested in how somebody else besides my therapist approached it.
Great. I'm glad you're enjoying group.
And congratulations on being a newlywed out there.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Okay. Thanks for calling and listening.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Wow. You know, one of the things that goes to me as far as being in a... talking about vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to imagine you... 12 years ago, I mean, do you ever sit back and think, this is what I was doing 12 years ago, and look what I'm doing now. How did I survive 12 years ago?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, my hope is that I'll be doing this work into my 70s.
But I mean, don't you see yourself improving? I mean, just the idea, just the challenge of I have this responsibility. There's a person in front of me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think I've grown quite a bit. Training for therapists is critical. Supervision, your own therapy is critical. And I, you know, private practice is actually quite isolating. The only people I interact with are my patients.
Do you have any support group or?
I don't currently. I have in the past. I've had mm-hmm. peer supervision groups, but honestly, I have a lot of my close friends are therapists, and it's great to be able to talk to them about what's going on, you know, obviously confidentially. Mm-hmm. I don't disclose any identifying information, but to get the support and say, I had a really hard session or I'm
what would be a really hard session? What would be an example of something?
To be honest, I think the hardest thing for me personally is suicidal patients. Because that really does take it up to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have many. I probably get one or two suicidal patients every other year. I mean, it's not very often. But you really
often
are dealing...
enough to keep you on your toes.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't find that my work interferes a whole lot outside of work hours, except when there's someone who's, you know... suicidal, where you really are having to make decisions about whether they need to go to the hospital, whether they can keep themselves safe. That stays with
you.
The
whole issue of lethality in it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is life or death. And that's very difficult. And then sometimes, I mean, the trauma work is very difficult. If you have a number of patients who've dealt with, you know, sexual trauma, physical trauma, that work is very difficult. And you need a lot of support for yourself because there's secondary trauma from, you know, hearing difficult stories over and over again.
And so this is where you go to your professional friends.
Yeah, who get it. I mean, mm-hmm. they get it. It's hard to explain to other people, you know, how hard it can be to hear difficult stories. That being said, you know, what a lot of people always say, you know, every time I go to a cocktail party and people say, of course, in Washington, what do you do? And I say, I'm a psychotherapist. They usually have a big reaction. One is, you know, it's either, oh, wow, you know, are you analyzing everyone at this cocktail party?
That's a nice way of saying they're feeling a little uncomfortable and on the spot, you
right.
know?
Right. But the second thing they usually just say is, wow, I could never listen to people's problems all day.
Yeah.
And I say, my response is usually, well, if I looked at it that way, then I couldn't do it either. I don't see it that way. I truly believe that it is an honor to witness people's journeys, people's pain, people's successes. I've seen people who were, you know, single and feeling like they would never be able to find a partner, that they would never become a parent. I've seen them go through all of those stages. And it's not to say that that means success, right? Success can just be simply a lot about, you know, how one feels about oneself. That's actually how I would measure success a lot more, but it's
like
an
going
honor
on
to
the
witness Appala- this.
It's like going on the Appalachian Trail. Success is not finishing the whole trail. Success is how you feel about the trip that you made.
Yeah, I mean, the way someone feels about themselves is everything. Mm-hmm. It truly, truly is.
And what you're really saying is the inside of people's is a golden place. To be honored, to be able to see that.
I do. I'm touched every day by people and their strength and their resilience. And who would want a therapist who looked at it like I'm just listening to people's problems all day? That's, you know, I love what I do. Does that mean that I don't have bad days or difficult days? Of course. I mean, everybody does.
Do you ever find yourself caught up in one session when the next one is going to start?
Again, I would just say when someone is suicidal, other than that
situation, you're able to make a division there.
No, in other situations, but
I'm saying in other situations, you find it easy to go from one session to the next.
I find it easy when I take care of myself, when mm-hmm. I get up and I stretch my legs and I get a glass of water and I, you know.
Let's talk about your behind. How does your behind handle all of this?
It's very funny you say that. I've had a tailbone injury for about a year and a half and not particularly happy.
From sitting?
No, I mean, I had an actual fall, but it's look, this is, you know, a lot of research talks about how, you know, sitting is the worst possible thing you can do. And it is truly what we must do.
I mean, you're not exactly this heavyweight who comes in here with 500 pounds of weight. You're svelte. I mean, so you're either eating like a mouse, or you're exercising, or, well, I have 15 minutes to do 30 push-ups, or...
I do exercise. I have a good metabolism. But, you know, it is difficult to sit for that long. I mean, I would say that might be one of the bigger challenges.
The actual physical challenge of the job.
I think so. Yeah, I do. You know, just kind of... you know, other people can quickly make a phone call during, you know, while they're on their computer or something. You know, they can multitask. Of course I can't multitask.
Absolutely not. That's right.
And so that can just be a little challenging.
And another thing, you have to be pretty powerfully dynamic in the sense, see, I immediately see that you're a good listener. This is obvious. You're very expressive. You're very emotional.
Thank you.
But... I think of the incident where we saw the two people, the guy putting his hands on the woman on
the sidewalk talk the other day.
And
I were there.
And, you know, you were like, I'm going to be right in on that and everything.
Yep.
I mean, you must have a, I don't know what the right word for it is, but you must have a real...
It's kind of a radar.
Well, also, but a dynamic presence in the sense of you have to be able to command your space like a cop. In a sense, that's a hard thing to say for a therapist, but you have to make a space for people, but you also have to have some serious limits and boundaries in your office.
Yes, I do.
Control certain things.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not, people don't want to see it. The days of, you know, wanting a therapist to be a complete blank slate, I think are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Many people come to me and they say, you know, my previous therapy, you know, I've been in therapy a couple times, and I'll say, well, what worked for you and what didn't. And most of the time what people say is that the person just sat there and nodded their head and was sort of benign, but really didn't do a dynamic, I didn't have a dynamic experience. And I think part of the reason people need therapy is to develop a strong attachment and connection to another person. And
the
they
therapist?
Don't, yeah. Yeah, for some people it's their best relationship. It's a different kind of relationship, but it is a relationship. I care very deeply for my patients, and I like to believe that some of them care very deeply for me. It doesn't mean every single one, and sometimes you don't, you know, the bond is not as easy to form.
There's chemistry, and sometimes there's not chemistry.
Sure, just like in all relationships,
right.
Absolutely.
Just like with a teacher in a class, the same thing.
But I truly believe that people appreciate that I am me. You know, I try to be as authentic throughout my life, and I think people who know me both personally and professionally would probably say that's true. I think people want to be across from a real person who has their own stuff. I don't bring my stuff. But guess what? When you do have a tailbone injury and you say to your patients, I'm sorry, I actually have to stand today, that brings my vulnerability in.
Yeah, but, you know, I also find in the listening experience, you want to make it about the other person, but that doesn't necessarily want to be a vacuum.
Right.
You know, I think that there's natural, a person needs a certain, like a tension there in a string to make it make its best sound. There needs to be a certain amount of something for it to, like a drum.
Mm-hmm.
You can't drum on a drum that's not tight.
Right.
You know, so there has to be some reaction and spring back.
Reverberation.
Or something like that.
Absolutely.
I mean,
right. And you know, so I find that a lot of people really just don't do well with the blank slate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give advice, but I...
You don't?
I would say if there are safety issues...
you have clear places you see, like with that man and the woman you saw, you were getting your bells are ringing there. You're thinking there's some alarms going on.
My background is domestic violence.
Uh-huh.
I worked for 2 years for House of Ruth after graduate school. So I do have a radar for that. And I, whether it's smart or not, I have a very difficult time passing that by if I see it. So when we were together in DuPont Circle, I just wanted my presence to be known. We didn't have to intervene at all. But
in that situation, as I said, like with a child, which I deal with more, where I see a parent losing it with a kid in the store, I often just walk up to them, although this is not the same thing with domestic violence necessarily, but I just often walk up to them and say, hi, how you doing today? Not even addressing the issue of what's going on with the parent and the kid, just being a parent with another or an adult with another adult when they really don't realize they desperately need to disengage for a minute and just get their
balance
back.
You're actually helping them pause.
And right.
So
clutch.
You're literally, you're forcing them to pause for a moment. And even if they come at you angrily, you've put a pause in what was going on.
And isn't that a great deal of what therapy is about when you're talking about relationships? You know, you always do this. You know, and you're saying, well, let's hold on a second there. Mm-hmm. Think of what you just said. Isn't that a lot of what therapy is? It's slowing things down.
Oh, my so many of my patients are racing through their feelings. They are absolutely racing through looking for solutions. And to be honest, they're frustrated sometimes when they come in, and I am telling them to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
But we learn about ourselves in the pause, not in the chaotically, you know, moving quickly.
So when I was talking about being dynamic and everything like that, you got two people in front of you, and they're really interested in hurting each other, not physically necessarily, mm-hmm. but they're angry at one another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that must be a tremendous, I mean, you know, I just think that would be, for me, that sounds like a challenge. How do you...
Yeah, I mean, I heard from another therapist who said to a couple and does say this, hey, you can fight for free at home. so that, you know, they're not particularly interested in just witnessing a fight. I will say, however, that part of what I need to do is understand how it goes down between them.
Mm-hmm.
So I will let people kind of argue for a short period of time because it's insight into what goes on. And they'll often turn to me and say, see, this is what goes on. And then I will, you know, I will stop them and I will slow them down. And it's not, you know, it's never about the trash or who takes out the trash.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about feelings underneath that. It's never about how you don't put the forks in the dishwasher the way
I won't name any names, but there was a person I was dealing with who was talking about a relationship and had many complaints.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I don't think what you're complaining about is the issue.
Right. But people don't see that.
Right.
They really believe
I think there's something that's making you unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't express what it is, and I don't think you're able to express what it is, but there is definitely a burning fire in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, often what's underneath is I don't feel appreciated. I feel, you know, like you don't see me for me. Our kids have gotten in the way. I mean, there's a lot underneath that. But a lot of it is, you know, about, I think, difficulty in roles and responsibilities. We've got two working parents in most families these days. That's a lot. People are tired. People are feeling like they're doing their absolute best, and yet their partner isn't happy. So it's a challenge. I like working with couples a lot, but it is challenging because if they don't know their own individual stuff, you know, I always say couples work comes out of individual work.
Do you often take couples, you meet them once or twice, and say, all right, now we're going to do some individual stuff?
Well, I would refer them out usually.
Oh, really?
They're individual, yeah. I don't usually see the same person for individual. And I will see, like, if I'm seeing an individual and they'd like me to meet their spouse for... just to help me understand them better, I will do that. And that can be very useful. Also, just to, you know, bring in somebody's mom or, you know, and do a session or two of family therapy or just to help me understand. Because people can describe, you know, their spouse forever. And then when I get to experience that person for myself, it really changes things.
Then you can also see what the reaction is in there. Now, you're a sex therapist too?
Yeah, I'm also a sex therapist.
And how does a person get to be a sex therapist?
Well, I'm currently doing a program where I will end up being certified in sex therapy, but I do sex therapy now. And
I mean, it's a very important, intimate part of relationships.
It is very important. And there's a lot that just doesn't get talked about. I'm amazed that couples can go as long as they do without ever having a real honest discussion about what they like, what they want, how they view their sexual relationship and its importance in intimacy in general. There's a lot that doesn't get talked about.
Is that the main role as you see it in sex therapy is getting people to be able to operate on themselves, work out things themselves? Is that the main lesson, say, to sort of bring light and openness to it?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it really just depends on who's coming through your door. Some people mm-hmm. are coming with an actual sexual dysfunction. Some people are coming trying to navigate polyamorous relationships. Some people are, you know, have low libido and don't know why. So it really just depends who's walking through your door.
Do you deal with a lot of gay clients?
I have some gay and lesbian and transgender and queer clients. Not a ton.
Do you find that they're basically, they have some of their own unique issues, but they're just people in relationships?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think that's that thing where we all want to be seen. We all want to be loved. We all want to be not judged, not criticized. And that is universal. Of course, there are differences in relationships based on, you know, sexual identity or gender identity.
Right. But how the community accepts or doesn't accept you, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's 8:55. It's 8:56, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
Time flies.
It does fly. Yeah, you told me that it would. It did. Thank you.
So we're coming up towards the end of this. If a person, well, basically, if they wanted to get in touch with you, I don't know if you're even taking patients at the moment.
I am accepting new patients and
trying to have more of those 8-hour days, right?
Right, exactly. You know, again, part of therapy is to graduate people. I love when people terminate with me appropriately when mm-hmm. it's time and when they think it's time. And I will suggest termination at times. I think there's a misconception that therapists want to keep people forever. Mm-hmm. My goal, just like parenting, is to kind of help you, you know, give you the foundation to figure stuff out on your own and then set you free. So again, people are always coming in and out of therapy.
With 2 minutes left to
yes.
go, although you've almost sort of said it, what is your favorite part of your practice?
Bearing witness to people's stories. Truly hearing people's stories. I am fascinated by people. I'm fascinated by what they do, why they do it. And noticing the absolute universal need to and desire to be connected, and that pain is pain. It doesn't know socioeconomic status. It doesn't know race. It doesn't know culture. And we all know about it. And also that mental health issues are universal. And they are severe. They are real. Depression is real.
Well, I hope I hit the right song there for my next piece that's coming up. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. That's Breylove.
Brooke Breylove.
And you can find her probably by looking under Brooke Breylove, but under...
Brookebreylove.com.
I guess you take people from anywhere in the metropolitan area.
Yeah, my office is located in downtown Bethesda, but I have people who come quite a distance to see me. Yeah.
Wow. What's that song? They all come back to me.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much. This is Dennis Price on the Radio Hotline. Hold on for a little bit. I'm going to play some music. And if I'm rocky, I got the right song. Yes, I did. Oh, good.
I'm looking through.